proceed to next case, Melton versus Melton. Mr. Robertson.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Donovan Robertson. I'm counsel for the appellate here, Alexandria Melton. Alexandria is the natural daughter of Richard Melton and Judy Melton. Richard Melton, when he was alive, worked for John Deere in Moline and was the beneficiary of, and was the owner of a group term life insurance policy, which is part of his benefits packet at John Deere. Richard was divorced from my client's mother, Judy Melton, in 1989. He remarried, he married Peggy Melton after he was divorced from my client, and then designated her as the primary beneficiary on his term life insurance policy that is the subject of this case and the subject of this appeal. Richard and Peggy were divorced in May of 2001. And Richard died later that year in December of 2001. Peggy was never taken off the form as his designated beneficiary. In the divorce proceeding that took place in Rock Island County, both parties waived their interest in each other's insurance policies and employee benefit plans, things of that nature. When Richard died, Peggy made a claim for the insurance as the designated beneficiary. My client, through her mother, made a claim because, well, principally she's arguing that the former Mrs. Melton waived her interest to that into the proceeds of that policy. Judge McDade disagreed with my client. Judge McDade ruled, the district judge ruled in favor of Peggy Melton, saying that, in essence, that ERISA preempts any state law claim that Alexandria Melton may have to the insurance proceeds here, and that Peggy's interests were not waived. I'd like to start out by addressing the preemption argument that was raised below. Section 1104D of ERISA provides, in essence, that payment of benefits under an ERISA-administered plan be made according to the designation in the plan. It also makes the assumption that ERISA preempts all state law in this regard. We do not agree with the district court's assumption in this regard and holding in this regard that ERISA preempts all state law concerning divorce, concerning payment of insurance proceeds. Naturally, that at first blush puts us at odds with the Supreme Court of the United States in the case of Egelhoff against Egelhoff. I believe the proper analysis under Egelhoff would require an analysis of the objectives of ERISA and the nature of the effect of the state law, in this case the state law concerning divorce and contract and the right to waive, or and the effect of the waiver in the divorce, the nature and effect of that state law upon ERISA. Looking at the first prong, if you will, certainly the primary objective, one of the primary objectives of ERISA is to ensure an income stream and the payment in an orderly fashion of benefits to an intended beneficiary or to a proper beneficiary. We assert that in this case, it was certainly not Mr. Melton's intention, once having divorced Mrs. Melton, that she receive his life insurance policy, the proceeds thereof. She was not, at the time of his death, his spouse. And if you look at the beneficiary designation that he had filled out, the final designation, it in fact had Mrs. Peggy Melton as the primary beneficiary and the children as contingent beneficiaries. It seems to me that to award the insurance benefits in this case to Peggy Melton is actually flying in the face of the first objective of ERISA, which would be to provide the benefits to the intended beneficiaries.
How many children were there?
There were three children. Your Honor. My client was the only child at the time of Mr. Melton's death who was a minor. The other two were emancipated.
So if Peggy had died, predeceased him, then as contingent beneficiaries, would it just be Alexandria, or were the other two, because they are no longer minors, would they be out?
I don't believe they would have been out. I believe that they would have each, I believe they would have received a pro rata portion. I don't believe their majority would have affected the distribution in this case. They did not make claims for the insurance policy. Only my client did. But in looking at it, I believe their majority did not affect, would not affect their right to get a portion of the policy.
So if you win, they'll come after you, probably.
Pardon, sir?
They'll come after you, after her, to get their share.
Almost undoubtedly. Mm-hmm. Again, with respect to the second prong, the nature of the effect of this state law upon ERISA, we don't feel that the state law in this regard in any way is going to frustrate ERISA, the orderly administration of ERISA, nor do we believe that this is any kind of an impermissible burden upon the administrators of an ERISA plan to determine who is or is not the intended and the proper beneficiary. I noted in the Egelhoff decision, which was authored by Justice Thomas, that there was a glancing remark to Slayer statutes, where almost every state in the union has a prohibition against payment of insurance proceeds to an individual who murders the owner of the policy when they're the beneficiary. And if you extend 1104D and assume of ERISA and assume that it preempts this field entirely, you get in this logically inconsistent and I think facially inconsistent area where a Slayer, in derogation of a Slayer statute, would, if you give ERISA full reign, the Slayer would actually, according to the plan, be the beneficiary of the insurance proceeds. And I don't think that result would be upheld in any court, but the analogy to the instant case is that Justice Thomas made passing reference to that and said, well, the Slayer statute really isn't before the court, which of course we could argue limits Egelhoff to the facts. But he also said that Slayer statutes are long have long been in our jurisprudence and are uniform among the states. And I would certainly assert that the divorce law, the divorce decree, the right to contract, the right to have to make these kinds of waivers would have every bit as much of a pedigree in our jurisprudence as the Slayer statutes. And for that reason, I don't believe that it's fully preempted. Our other argument has to do with waiver, the validity of the waiver. We believe the waiver was valid. If you look at the waiver that's contained in the divorce decree, the settlement agreement upon which there was a judgment entered, the language is plain that each party waives their interest as beneficiary unto the other's insurance policies.
You made that argument to the district court?
The argument was contained in, I was not trial counsel, but it was contained in a response to the motion for summary judgment. And I believe that was at appendix number, it was entry number 35 on the on the filing numbers in the district court. And I note, Judge, that Judge McDade said that argument was waived. We do not believe that argument was waived, that the waiver argument was waived. In fact, he brought it up in his opinion. Judge Gorman, the magistrate's recommendation and report, didn't mention anything about a waiver of the argument. In fact, it was considered. We do not believe it was waived. In any event, we believe that would be this court's determination.
Did the dissolution of marriage agreement specifically speak to these employee death benefits, Ms. Robertson?
It spoke to life insurance policy benefits. It did not say the John Deere life insurance policy benefit. But it spoke in broad language as to any beneficiary of any insurance policies. Briefly, we feel that federal common law should fill in the gaps here, not contained in ERISA in Section 1104D, and specifically would refer the court to the case of Manning versus Hayes, which is in the brief, as well as this court's decision in Fox River Construction Benefits versus and Vicinity Plan versus Brown, upon which I believe both of your honors took part, and it was non-bonk decision. That case supports our position that federal common law can fill in what gaps are not specifically addressed by ERISA, and in this case, that gap having to be the validity of the waiver. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson. Mr. Koenig?
I'm Phil Koenig. I represent Peggy Melton. May it please the court, worthy opponent, Mr. Robertson, and your honors. Mr. Robertson has made statements that the United States Supreme Court has answered, and which the district court, in its proper disposition of this case, pointed out peculiarly the three-prong holding in Egelhoff states that payment is to be made in accordance with the plan provisions. The document on which Mr. Robertson bases his claim is not a plan document. He's maintaining that a divorce judgment holds, it contains a waiver. That's clearly not a plan document. It is not a quadro. It's not something that the plan administrator has. So it violates the 1104A1D rule that the fiduciary shall administer the plan in accordance with the documents. The plan itself says that payments are to be made to the beneficiary designated. Mr. Robertson's appendix properly included the salient portions of the summary plan description which say that payment on the life insurance will be made to the beneficiary designated by the insured.
Yeah, but it's true that a spouse can waive her rights to ERISA benefits in a divorce proceeding if a property settlement agreement specifically waives the beneficiary's interest. And isn't that what this case is about? Isn't the whole ERISA dispute almost irrelevant when we have a waiver here?
No.
Why not?
Egelhoff says that state law will not control the disposition of ERISA protected benefits, of which this is one. The state court judgment is an act of state law under the definition set forth in 1144 as to what state law is.
Yeah, but hasn't the Seventh Circuit applying Illinois law held that a decree of divorce affects the rights of a divorced spouse only if the property settlement agreement specifically includes a provision terminating the beneficiary's interest?
I think that is the essential holding of the Brown case, that this court has previously heard. However, and I'll get to it, our case is factually distinguishable from that.
How so? Especially when you look at the language of the waiver. That seems to me the waiver language is really clear when it says this waiver shall include life insurance policies, which is found in the appendix A30, last paragraph.
I discussed this at length in my brief.
I understand that.
First of all, the mutual release provision to which counsel makes reference talks about, to the fullest extent by law, we hereby forever relinquish, waive, and forever quit claim, and it names all rights of maintenance, alimony, dower, pension, inheritance, descent, community property, and all rights, title, and interest as husband and wife, or otherwise by reason of the marital relationship. The life insurance is not a matter of the marital relationship. It's a contract right offered by Mr. Melton's employer.
Right, and this, and it ends with neither party waives the right to seek Social Security benefits that arise out of the marriage. And, of course, if it had stopped there, then the whole line of cases that you cited, I think, would be right on point. But when you look at what's in this last paragraph, right, in the last sentence, I think that's what distinguishes our situation here.
And I don't. The second paragraph begins, as to any asset assigned to a party by this agreement, if evidenced by an instrument naming the non-owning party a beneficiary, such interest is hereby revoked by the non-owning party. That first clause of the first sentence says, as to any asset assigned to a party by this agreement. The marital settlement agreement attached is a part of the exhibit makes no reference to the life insurance policy. It talks about a pension plan, it talks about certain other things, but it makes no mention to anything else. This life insurance policy is not necessarily part of a pension plan. As Your Honors held in Metropolitan versus Johnson, the life insurance policy is a wealth, health and welfare benefit. It is not a part of the pension. The Fox Valley case had a death benefit under the pension that the parties were disputing. The pension itself, not Deere and Company, or some other employer, was made a party. The language used in the Fox Valley case addressed a pension. In this case, the pension is irrelevant. It is a group term life insurance, health and welfare benefit that's not referred to, and the specific language used in the divorce judgment is not specific enough under this court's previous holdings and under Manning versus Hayes, to which my worthy colleague made reference, to the level of specificity required to effect a waiver. And as furthermore, the Egelhoff case sets forth a bright line test. They're saying that the distribution of pension benefits is to be done in accordance with plan documents only. It is the very argument that Judge Mannion made in the dissent in Fox Valley that said it has to be done in accordance with plan documents, and that these are rules. And these rules exist for a reason, so that these benefits can be efficiently and effectively administered in a uniform manner, not requiring knowledge by the pension administrators of extant divorce decrees and other documents. So, to that end, I think the Supreme Court in Egelhoff has said that the position taken in the dissent in Fox Valley is now the law. And I would go out so far on a limb as to say if the waiver were contained only in a divorce judgment and were not made a part of the plan document by the available vehicle, a quadro, it would have no effect upon the distribution of the benefits themselves. The Supreme Court has said we are not going to require pension administrators to look everywhere and to know the laws of each and every jurisdiction. Rather, they are to look at the plan documents themselves and make their decision.
Well, what about the Fifth Circuit Cliff case, in which there was a federal court that found waiver upon reading of the language of the divorce decree and determining that the wife had waived her beneficial interest in the life insurance proceeds?
The Cliff case predates Egelhoff.
And that's the only distinction you want to draw?
Yes. We now are limited to the plan documents, just the same as if we had, as Judge Easterbrook put in his dissent in the Fox Valley, like you would with a will. The only enforceable wills are those with two witnesses signed by the decedent. You know, the various kinds of letters that are unwitnessed are not enforceable as wills, even though they pretend to be what people want to do with their property. I see my time is up, and I thank you for listening politely. Again, I believe the Egelhoff cases, in its three commands, are compelling in this circumstance.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you.
Mr. Robertson? Your time has expired, but you may have a minute.
Thank you. I just have two brief points to make. First of all, with regard to the waiver argument, which Mr. Koenig was making and indicating that somehow the language did not amount to a waiver, I think the standard that we need to look at is whether a reasonable person looking at that language would construe that a waiver was made. And I think when you read that document as a whole, including the precatory remarks made early on about advice of counsel and full understanding and so forth, I think we've certainly crossed that threshold in this area. And lastly, and I'm really repeating what I said initially, I don't think that Egelhoff paints with such a broad brush that every situation is going to be preempted by the terms of ERISA, especially where we have a situation involving waiver here. This seems to be one of those areas that needs to be filled in with federal common law, borrowing either from state law or building upon itself. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Robinson. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The fifth case of the day, Tesu versus the INS, will be taken on the briefs.